This is the Moonfest Destiny podcast. Moonfest Destiny is a novel I wrote back in 1991. If this is the first time you're listening to the podcast, please start with episode one. The subtitle of the novel is The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. In this episode, I will read chapter 18. The moral surgeon does his dastardly duty. Down in the dark and dirty dugout, suffering the small earthquakes of bombardment all that first day, May 2nd, 1846, we Company C crawdads complimented one another on all the glory we were earning easy, just sitting there and suffering. We were shoved in so tight in our crawdad hole to one side of the main gallery that our legs overlapped every which way. There was a bit of cheerless kicking now and then. Kelly chimed in, trying to talk like an officer, which to him was the same thing as a nabob. We must recognize that Sergeant Weigert's death was a noble sacrifice for the greater good of our national glory. I mean glory, 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 he corrected himself angrily. Them is principles worth dying for, he insisted, in his own natural grammar. Yes, sir, said Six Fingers, turning his big ears on his long, skinny neck. What principles exactly are we fighting for again, sir? Just so I know. I'm sitting here trying to write a letter to one of my wives, and I thought I'd just put down two or three of those principles you mentioned, except you didn't mention them by name exactly, sir, he said, waving his dirty quill. The feathers tickled my nose. Right, agreed my brother, rocking on his heels. Take this down. Here we go. My dear madame, etc., etc., your husband is fighting for, that is, we are, all defending, or, yes, that's it, start over. Here we go. Why are we on the moon? Perhaps you've wondered that question yourself. Perhaps you're wondering if your husband's death will be justified, or should that unthinkable event be required? The answer, madame, without prevarication, with all due alacrity, is a sacred cause. The cause, my dead madame, etc., for which we 7th Infantry cotton balers fight to defend, is the life and livelihood of Americans on American soil. God help us! Land sakes, that bomb was a close one. And freedom and liberty's destiny. Where was I? Well, gol dang it, Mrs. Bordet, this here moon is the lunar peninsula of Texas, fair and square. We all know it. We got to obey our elected president, and he says it is. And the pesky mooners started it by killing us first. That's the best I can do, Private. I ain't Henry Shakespeare. Tick, 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 tick. That clockwork sound, we come to know, preceded the appearance of the newcomer, Prince President Franklin Stove, the metal man of the fort, an automaton, the gift of Polk's cabinet. Lo, and speak of the devil, a cloud of steam and coke smoke slowly solidified into his own handsome personage. Behind him was the music lad, coughing. All the crawdads looked at the man-gin with curiosity and respect, too, seeing as he was a prince president standing at the top of the artificial aristocracy. PPFS stared around in the gloomy underground blindly, and we all stared back at his weird white porcelain pumpkin of a face. We stared at his stiff, effeminately sculpted, benign expression, his Beau Bremer rouged cheeks, his permanently ever so slightly pursed lips, from which the trickling, escaping words of steam came when he spoke. Eroo! Tick, stick, stick, tick, ick, ick. He tugged on his square-cut porcelain beard, looking at nothing as he looked at us. Now, under siege, the war began. We discovered that he wore a white diagonal sash over his black preacher's suit, a sash that read, "Moral Surgeon." But the thing I noticed most was his whirling, swirling toy marble eyes. So heavy and sticky was their stare. They seemed to hold you in a mesmerist trance of animal magnetism. Staring at those gray glass marbles, you got so you doubted dizzily your own existence. As the shells burst and brown shot bounced above our heads, the ticking automaton began to speak in a voice, fluid and calm, quietly humming virtuous, like a lead pipe organ, or even more so like the church organ's poor cousin, P.T. Barnum's Circus Calliope. Although slightly suffering a dandy's lisp on account of the escaping steam pressure of his words. Death has come on rooster wings, while some gentlemen crow, "War! War!" and some tremulously peep, "Peace, please!" But in the latter case, those gentlemen are mostly, are they? As follows. Tick. One. Furriest free love harlots, and two. Two. Menu miss. Tick. Many misfinished Jeanne d'Arcs, and three temperance shrews. A question follows. Tick. Where is the spot where life and livelihood of our citizens succumb to the worm of war, lest it be the blush of fever on liberty's cheeks? We stared at him. I got a sort of inkling he didn't stand shoulder to shoulder with us on the question of defending the P of T. However, he was such an odd fellow, I didn't take it personal. I decided to laugh two or three times, like it was a joke. But Kelly, he turned livid. He opened his mouth to speak forth his brilliant retort, then closed it again, over and over, like a landed Chesapeake catfish. He grounded his teeth, squared his shoulders, and in the process of squaring them, rattled and clattered his saber in its scabbard, a noise that always impressed us doughboys. He marched close. But first he had to swipe off his shako and stood down a little on account of the low ceiling of the bombproof and stood face to face with the travesty talking automaton. Listen, it's nearly a week since Lunarista's cavalry ambushed our scouts on this side of the cold sea and murdered them. I got up and stood behind my brother because he was my brother, as I had often done when Kelly faced off against the hired hands of our neighbor, Mr. Spooner. I added, "Yeah, and what do I want to know is, if you're a peace wig, where's your hairpiece?" Under his hot stovepipe, his hair was a porcelain mold, never needing combing, much unlike my own mop. But his was never sanctuary for patriotic American jiggerbugs, unlike my own. Tick-ree! Tick! The Prince President looked at us. And I got a bit lost inside the foggy gray swirly-whirlies of his glass eyes. Eggs-ackly. Tick, he answered Kelly. This side of the Mare Frigoris, eggs stens all the way from the moon of... from the moon to teg... eggs tick to the Nueces River. To be eggs-explicit. Tick, to be precise. Therefore, Lieutenant, your answer begs eggs. Tick craves the question. The question craves an answer, as follows. Tick. Question. Is this fort exactly situated on this chicken-poxed lunar spot to defend Americans on our own soil? Kelly swayed and blinked at the whirlings and swirlings of the metal man's eyeballs. He just squawked out automatically, "Hooray for Jackson! To the victor goes the spoils!" Tick. 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 The Prince President calculated his Babbage machine mind as we all lifted our kepis, those first-generation baseball caps, and hurrah to the bank slayer. "Sir," he bowed, "I am no man for you. That's quite all right, said Kelly, subdued. Let no man accuse you of being a mere tailor's dummy in regular blue. I thank you, Kelly nodded. Then he turned around and unsure squinted at the benign face. Let no man accuse you of being a mere mob-minded puppet-mouthing penny-press lies. Angry again, but still unsure, Kelly took refuge in dignity. He clasped his hands behind his back, as Major Brown so often did. Mister, is that the proper respect shown an officer of the United States Army in a time of war at that? PPFS merely blinked his tin eyelids rhythmically, turned around, and marched out of the dugout. He ticked, turned right, and marched down the gallery to dugout two. He was just doing his metal duty. He was just making his moral rounds. It was darkening. Our guns ceased firing. But the Lunars kept dropping howitzer shells on us, an easy target, although entrenched. Something thudded, and dirt trickled down from the shelter's roof. Old Sock scooted by in the gallery, hunched over to keep the dirt out of Captain and Mrs. Miles' poached eggs. I chewed hardtack and biscuit and fell in fitful sleep. I dreamed that we crawdads caught Joseph Bentley kissing Sarah. So we all grabbed him and took him by the hair and dunked his pretty boy head in a water bucket and held him there. We held him there and held him there, though he kept thumping the side of the bucket, thumping, thumping. I woke up. Outside, the ghosts of Aztec gods beat their war hammers on the sand. Thank you for listening. Moonfest Destiny by Peter Gelman is available on Kindle for 99 cents. You could support this podcast by buying it. Thank you. Couple notes. Some people may not know that coke is a form of coal. They mentioned the Nueces River, that's in Texas. And there's a question of where the preliminary violence of the confrontation of the two nations, where it happened, as a pivot for the moral question of the righteousness of the war. Problem is the national boundary was not agreed upon. They were pioneer regions of both nations, or at least undeveloped. And he mentions kepis, that's a form of hat. The shako is one that I associate with the Napoleonic era. It's generally sticks up really high, makes the soldier look taller and fiercer. I think they're often beaver pelts. These were evolving into something more moderate at this time, and also the kepis, they're littler versions with visors. And so that's just a little theory I have with no proof or research behind it, that since baseball was developing self-consciously at this time, that maybe that is the source of what we now call the baseball cap. The P of T, I'm not sure if that's obvious or not, that's the Peninsula of Texas. That's part of the subtitle and a major conceit of the novel. The moon is the Peninsula of Texas. And PPFS, Prince President Franklin Stove, the coal-powered android, mechanical man. I went to Brownsville and I found the fort, the old fort. I don't remember if I mentioned that before, but it looks like it's been half or more than half bulldozed. And the remaining ramparts are pretty close to the river and sort of the backstop to a small golf course. But you could see the mound where presumably some of those bomb shelters were. And the Daughters of the American Revolution erected a cannon muzzle down as a column. And that's about it. That's about the only commemoration of the battle site. It's sort of a behind buildings, not a park or anything like that. At the time, it annoyed me is thought of it as archaeological censorship. Maybe kind of embarrassing or something. But people died there, so I think it deserves a better tribute. Thank you very much for listening. Next chapter, this is the second day of siege.